Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a return guest, somebody who was very popular last time he appeared on the show because I think dental issues are one of the things in healthcare that people don't talk a lot about. We don't know a lot about it, and it affects everybody at some point. So today we're going to welcome Dr. Leonard Fazio back. He completed a maxi residency at Tufts University Dental School in Boston, certifying him in the field of biological dentistry, biological oral surgery, and dental implantology. At present, there's only about 65 dentists worldwide who've received this level of education. Biological dentistry is a concept designed to revolutionize the field of oral surgery due to its ability to completely eliminate disease from the jawbones and properly restore anatomy and function in cases where infected teeth and dead bone are surgically removed. He's been mentored by Dr. Sharam Ganati, based in Frankfurt, Germany, was just installed as the first medical director at the International Academy of Biological Dentistry and Medicine, a biological dental organization. And last time Dr. Fazio came on, we had an excellent conversation about dental health and what that really means. And I think, Dr. Fazio, we see a lot of things on TV just pushing cosmetic dentistry and people getting teeth removed that may not have the need for their teeth to be removed in order to put in these dental implants. And what strikes me about what you do, it's not one size fits all. And there's so many ways to approach the teeth that don't involve being really aggressive all the time. And today I wanted to have a conversation with you about the dental, about dental nutrition, about how we can take care of our teeth in such a way that we don't end up needing to have our teeth removed or have root canals and all the other things that people that go on in the dental industry. So I wanted to welcome you back today. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Hello, Dr. George. So glad to be back with you today. Thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So I want to revisit why you ended up in holistic dentistry, because that's such a specialized group and a small subset of the dental profession. Exactly what led you to this niche? I think it should be not a niche anymore, but it should be how all dentists practice. But how'd you end up?
Well, I agree with you there that it should be part of the general education of dentists, but that's probably some years away. Again, my situation was quite unique in that although I had a conventional dental education at New York University, and upon graduating in 1988, I embarked in the field as I was taught to provide services and treatment on people, as most everyone has done. It's a pretty universal protocol that those that are taught to students all over the country. But about 3 years after graduation, I had some unique health challenges presenting slowly at first, which then began to snowball. And Dr. George, what ultimately occurred was that there were days that I had absolutely zero energy. I had bouts of confusion, tachycardia, which is an elevated heart rate for no reason at all, just spontaneous or idiopathic, as they described. Wearing sunglasses indoors because extreme sensitivity to light and sound, and just hardly any patience for anything. I found myself very short-tempered, getting upset and remaining upset for extended periods of time, which for me was completely out of character. Well, again, as I alluded to, it came on quite slowly, so I didn't panic right away, but I just thought after a while, something was changing. And there was a couple of times there were a couple of jobs, I should say, where there were days I could not get out of bed. And after calling in sick more than once, I was let go of the jobs. And that's when I started to get really concerned that something's not right. And this was, again, out of character for me. And I just felt really poorly. I just was a shadow of myself. Well, long story short, I go to my local physician, who was a friend, and had every kind of test run on me, blood work, EKGs, EEGs, every kind of blood panel, and nothing was found. He pronounced me fit and healthy. And although I had a significant list of symptoms I was complaining of, he offered no diagnosis nor any solution. And at that time, it suggested that I go, quote unquote, speak to someone about maybe some mental health issues that were latent. And I thought, no, that's not me. That's never been me. And it's not a, you know, family issue. And I was forlorn. I felt lost and didn't know what to do. And he just shrugged his shoulders and said, I'm really sorry. I can't help you. Okay, I continued to do my best and live my life, but it just so happened, Dr. George, and here's the key, because it's not that I woke up one day and say, I'm just going to practice differently, but in a roundabout way, I got turned on to an alternative view on the safety and efficacy of certain dental materials that turned out to be my Achilles heel, if you will. Specifically, the use and manipulation of mercury amalgam fillings, or the silver fillings, as people call them, that everyone takes for granted. And it turned out that after one of my older sisters began her own journey for better health, that she came across the issue that amalgam fillings may be presenting a challenge, let's say, to us. Now, I'm one of five people, siblings who all had basically the same dental care. We had access to dental care from a young age, meaning in my case specifically, I've had dental fillings put in my mouth from as early as 6 years old. And again, back in the 1960s, the only option for placement of fillings was the amalgam filling, not realizing that the mercury contained within would eventually start poisoning me. But when I look back now, there were certain childhood issues I had, specifically tinnitus, which is the ringing of the ears, that could also not be explained away. Today, we know that mercury exposure, or acute or chronic mercury exposure, can result in tinnitus, among other health challenges. And so in my case, I had a long history of mercury exposure starting in childhood, which came to a head quite literally when I started practicing dentistry full time. So this unique series of events that occurred, kind of the perfect storm, if you will, eventually resulted in my expressing symptoms that no one could figure out. We'll call it a syndrome, because a lot of the symptoms I had are very common and could theoretically be grouped together and labeled a syndrome for persons who have chronic mercury exposure. As it turns out, most people, maybe not today, but persons who are born in the 60s and 70s, were born to parents who also had mercury fillings. And so the exposure to mercury starts from conception. Again, depending on someone's overall exposure during the course of their lifetime, whether they require dental fillings or they didn't, will lead to a certain body burden, which then can eventually manifest, assuming you get to a certain breaking point to which the body cannot handle or squirrel away or store away the mercury as it did in my body. So what we came to find out was that the reason my blood work and other tests did not reveal mercury exposure, which ultimately was the cause of my illness, it was because my body had done up to a certain point, stored away the mercury in body tissues, not allowing it to be detected in the blood. And not until we had a urine provocation test could we measure or determine that there was mercury in my body, which would not come out or be excreted without the help of a chelating agent. I think at the time we used DMPS. So I took a one-time injection of DMPS, collected my urine afterward, and that's when we finally saw for the first time that mercury was, there was quite a bit of it that came out in my urine afterward. That confirmed what we all suspected at the time, which again, I'm cutting to the chase here, but ultimately a dentist who treated my sister suggested I go see a dentist by the name of Hal Huggins in order to just sort of confirm that what I was going through was kind of par for the course for a lot of dental personnel. And then in October of, let's say, 1992, which was about 3 years after, 4 years after graduating, I finally got the confirmation that my symptoms were consistent with a chronic and acute mercury poisoning. And the reason why my lab works and stuff didn't reveal my cause, let's say the etiology, we were able to confirm that due to the fact that my occupation exposed me to more mercury as I was working with it, on top of having a mouthful, quite literally, let's say, I think 13 teeth had mercury fillings in them. Okay. So again, my body was contending with mercury exposure. Let's call that the chronic exposure for many years, right up through college and into dental school. But once I got my occupational exposure, that's what pushed me over the edge. So it was a perfect storm. It wasn't the same situation that most dentists go through. And therefore I was pretty much all alone. So once I received this new information, a second education, if you will, I had the very good fortune. And here's the really important part here, Dr. George. I had the very good fortune of hooking up with a dentist who had already been established as a quote-unquote holistic or biological dentist, who had an office set up where mercury amalgam fillings were not an option, and that the environment in his office was climate-controlled and also aerosol-controlled to avoid occupational exposure. And once I started working for him, again, P.S., he offered me a job and I took it without looking back. Then I was able to get into an environment where I limited my additional exposures. And within 6 months, most of my symptoms had quieted down quite a bit. In that interim, I also learned a lot about nutrition and medicine. And I started really taking care of myself and my wife and my children at the same time, where we sort of practice what we preach, which we'll go into details later. But the fact is, my experience is not the norm. Okay. Again, I think my childhood and the exposure I received then kind of set me up to fall 3 years out of school. But when I look at it now, it's probably a blessing. Although I never want to feel that way again, I have to look at it that something occurred to me that changed the course of my life, changed my practice professionally. My personal changes are well documented, but I would tell you that it's not what most dentists go through. Mercury exposure, for example, is very insidious. It's quiet. It sneaks up on you. It doesn't hit you all at once. But if you ask a lot of dentists out there, you know, what is the reason you retired? Many of them are going to cite neurological issues, tremors, shaking of hands, vision changes. Also, it affects your, as we now know, personality, like the old Mad Hatter syndrome, we call it. And though the patient or the dentist or the dental personnel are not aware of the changes, it manifests slowly, again, insidiously over the course of time, to the point where at some point you're altered, you're changed. Now, some people who don't have a mouth burden, let's say, aren't going to have the huge body burden that makes their symptoms so severe like mine were. But if you kind of logically look at this, saying that, you know, chronic exposure to one of the most toxic substances known to mankind is probably not a great idea. Most dentists are not taught, unfortunately, how to protect themselves in their practice because amalgam fillings, officially speaking, are not considered a problem. And that was really the rub, where most of my friends didn't want to believe that what I was going through was real. They thought I was, I don't know, making it up. And as a result, I became kind of an island unto myself. Although I was working with someone for a while, once he retired, I was like the only dentist around my area for miles and miles and miles around who had this kind of training and experience. And therefore, I just kind of isolated myself, because back in those days, anyone who got wind of that could have made significant trouble for me, meaning I could have lost my license for espousing the safe removal amalgam filling, or even suggesting to someone who might have had a laundry list of medications that they were taking that maybe the dental work, specifically your mercury fillings, may have something to do with your ill health. So we had to be really careful. Again, this is before the internet. So, you know, we had to vet any patient that came in, had to be vetted properly. The referral source had to be vetted also to make sure that someone wasn't going to be coming in and hate to use the term, but ratting me out to the local dental board. Again, I had a young family and I just thought, I want to stay in business, but here I have all this information and I can't really advertise. And so I just slowly plugged along and just thought, well, one patient at a time. And over the course of the last 38 years, this has now not only grown into more of a global issue, you know, where people have knowledge of it, but locally, we're seeing now younger persons getting hip to the idea that, hey, this stuff is probably not good for us. A lot of young families coming in, getting their mercury out before considering, you know, having children, these kind of things, which is finally now kind of hit the mainstream. So again, just to recap, my situation was different. Again, it really was a blessing in disguise, because then for the last 30 odd years, everything changed for me, and in a good way. Although it was challenging to be, you know, someone who's the only one practicing this way, those persons who did come in were so wonderfully thankful and appreciative of someone like me sort of not taking a stand, but just sticking with it. To be honest with you, Dr. George, there were times that things were really lean and I'm thinking, what am I doing here? No one's calling on the phone. I couldn't advertise the fact that what I was doing. I didn't want to draw unwanted attention on myself. But the fact was that I just stuck with it, knowing that I can't unknow what I know. and just figure that maybe someday things will turn around. Now, P.S., that did happen. There are plenty more dentists nowadays. Thank goodness that this information is freely available for people to make up their own minds. So again, my situation different, but again, because it affected me personally, that's why I made the commitment to change my practice. And thankfully, nowadays it's, you know, we're less worried, I say, than any dentist who wants to get involved or who feels that biological approaches to dental care makes more sense than what we were taught in school, which is really just like medicine at large, is treating symptoms and not really getting to the root cause, part of the pun there, is we are now feeling more like doctors rather than just glorified tooth mechanics. So in my case, again, I've been doing that for a while. It's been the best thing ever, again, not only professionally, but certainly personally for me and my family.
Well, I want to personally thank you because I had a patient that came in with lichen planus, which is this chronic inflammatory condition along the gum line.
Yeah.
And after our interview, I was much more attuned to the dental side of this. And she had this amalgam. The tooth was broken, so it was actually touching the buccal mucosa.
Okay,
and right along the line, it was, my God, I mean, this has got to be the reason because it's adjacent, it's rubbing. And she ended up getting the tooth out and the filling, obviously, and the lichen planus resolved. So it was like, okay, I'm with you. I was with you before, but just to see that play out so as a one-to-one in my practice, I want to thank you personally.
I'm so glad, Dr. George. The funny part is that things are logical. You know, we're kind of almost denying the logic, or dentists are, where you think, all right, I know it's bad, but yet we were told it's okay, so we just, you know, ignore that and move on. But something as simple as your, you know, broken filling or mercury in direct proximity or in contact with that mucosa, creating that local reaction, most dentists would say, oh, this is a systemic issue, or let's send you to the oral surgeon and go get a brush biopsy or something there to confirm that it's lichen planus, and then, okay, what? Take an oral steroid.
Exactly.
Something, again, treating the symptom. So here you go. Sometimes it's really, the solution is really simple.
I've loved it. I looked like a genius, right? She was using a topical steroid, which usually is on the skin, on the outside. I've never seen it used in the mouth for weeks. And just fixing the problem was just amazing. Now you're going to turn me on to things like tinnitus, because there's a normal hearing test with tinnitus. I'm going to be looking at the mouth aggressively to see if that's what's going on.
There you go. You know, I've said this to every physician I meet, Dr. George. Most of them, you know, they'll check blood pressure, they'll ask you some questions and, you know, listen to your breathing and stuff. But when they really complete their exam, they look right past the teeth and look to the back of the throat, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very few people take into account what's the real estate looking like in there. You know, to what degree is there an odor? Is there multiple missing teeth or teeth that are broken down and such? And unfortunately, most physicians are not taught to consider that, hey, that's a problem. And maybe the reason that patient's sitting in your chair there is because of something that you just look right past. So the dentistry part, again, I think any logical person, and thankfully, again, the information is freely available, can realize that due to the nature of dental work, which technically is very invasive. In fact, maybe 90%+ of the invasive procedures that somebody undergoes in the course of their lifetime occur right in their mouth. And so you have to know that anything that's done, there's going to be repercussions. There's always a cause and the effect once dental work is done. In the realm of biological dentistry, we're number one trying to minimize or prevent dental intervention, but also knowing that when we have to intervene, to be mindful of the material. Certain procedures have to be done differently, but, you know, be mindful of the fact that there's going to be a side effect, an effect, and just make sure that we can maximize the positive and minimize the negative.
I think that's a wonderful place to stop and take our first break. So let's do that and come back.
Okay.
You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Leonard Fazio, and you can go to his website. It's called holisticsmiles.com. That's correct. Am I right?
Yes, it is.
And there you can read what really mercury safe dental wellness and things that are not usually obvious when you go to the dentist. And I wanted to go back a bit and talk about dental health from the foundation. So let's talk about children for a second.
Please.
And I've had patients come to tell me that their children were getting teeth removed and doing fluoride rinses and all sorts of things. Dental health starts when you're a kid. You just described the fact that you had all these fillings. What can parents do when their kids have dental cavities and their baby teeth, for example? Do they need to have their teeth pulled? Do they need these fluoride rinses? Is there a risk and benefit to them?
Well, let's start with, let me slightly correct you if I can. I want to say dental health starts in utero.
Okay.
So if we back all the way up to before we see that child born in this in the world, we can, and I hate to use the term, we're pointing the finger at mom, but let's say the average OBGYN is probably not counseling their pregnant patient as well as they could, nutritionally speaking, to ensure that the developing fetus is going to have everything he or she needs to, you know, be born a healthy, vibrant human. Things as simple as, so basically when we see cavities forming, and it's just usually the first indication that something's not right. A child comes in, a young kid, 3 years old, mouthful of cavities. We're not really thinking, oh my God, terrible diet, and that mom's giving that kid too much sugar. On the contrary, although sugars are, you know, an issue, when I see a young child with rampant caries or cavities, the first thing I think about, I want to ask mom, tell me about your pregnancy. Any issues, anything out of the ordinary? And if it was, let's say, an unremarkable pregnancy, then I'll ask, okay, fine. Tell me about your nutrition. What did you eat? And I'll even go as far as asking mom, if she's not already an established patient, to let me take a look in her mouth and see what environment in her mouth then led to her own systemic environment, which hosted that baby for the last previous 9 months, plus however many years that kid's been on the planet, and then start looking backward, okay, and thinking, okay, if you want to know the answer, it could very well be signs showing in mom's mouth. That could be that that child was already born, for example, if the mother has mercury in her teeth, that child's already born with a mercury burden in the body as that child's getting exposure in utero. And those, you know, those kind of exposures then can upset the balance, which, as we know, we're very delicate beings, us humans. And then if one thing is off or there's not enough of something, then there's going to be an imbalance. And so we look at caries as a systemic symptom. Okay, it's not a dietary or oral hygiene issue. It's more of a systemic imbalance. So the symptom, again, is the tooth decay, but the cause for the decay usually is biochemical. Okay, so meaning, I think depending on who you talk to, probably the first thing that occurs to allow cavities to form, whether it's in a child or in an adult, is the calcium phosphorus ratio is off in the blood. Okay, there should be a 2-to-1 ratio of calcium to phosphorus. Once that is altered, whether that's environmental stress, dietary stress, genetics, whatever, then that sort of allows this cascade of events that can lead to tooth decay. Additionally, most women, most newborn children, and most people at large are not taking nearly enough vitamin D3 with the K2, which will also help maintain bone health. And we look at teeth as specialized bones, so teeth health also will benefit from adequate vitamin D3. And then the other issue I have with the OBGYNs out there, most of them, is that they're not counseling their patients to do that. Most of those patients maybe are told, take your folic acid and here's your prenatal. And that's about the extent of the nutritional consultation. What about keeping your body's pH level? How about making sure there's enough alkalizing foods? And how about some mineral sources? As we know now, the soils in this country are depleted because of overfarming. And even if someone's getting, you know, organically farmed foods, it doesn't mean that there's a good nutritional content in the soil, which eventually makes it to the food. So, among other things, we have to supplement minerals, which are the basic building blocks we'll need for so many things, whether that's biochemical or, let's say, structural. And strong teeth and bones is one of those things. So when someone's presenting in my office with caries, I say, okay, we're looking at a chronic situation here. This didn't happen overnight. And so if we can kind of pick out where did things go awry, was it nutritional? Was it biochemical? Was mom not a healthy person? Was mom's mouth full of mercury and root canals? Was there other mitigating circumstances? Then we can start unraveling, where did this come from? Instead of telling that kid, like most dentists, you need to brush more and let's throw some fluoride on there. That kid needs more fluoride. Again, conventional dentistry is treating the symptoms. No one is interested. Again, we're not taught to even consider this in dental school to find out why is this happening. Okay, so it's easy and convenient to just wrap it up as an oral hygiene issue and stay away from sugar in the conventional world. And here's some fluoride to make that go away. As we now know, fluoride is minimally efficacious, meaning it's just barely good at, you know, stopping a cavity or certainly preventing it. It's suspect, I should say. Its ability to do so is suspect. But we know that fluoride is toxic. So let's throw some toxic material in there and treat that symptom, and that just kind of compounds the issue. In a biological office, then we say, all right, well, you know, we're not going there. Let's see what we can do to systematically start getting that child or that adult patient back on track and have the conversation about the diet, nutrition, what to do, when to do it, and that kind of thing. We still have to treat, you know, issues. If they're, the cavities are big enough and, you know, they're threatening the vitality of the teeth, well, yes, we don't want teeth to be removed prematurely. We want to save them in order to have them hold space for the emerging adult teeth that'll come later on. But another reason, so we have to look at it and say, all right, maybe it's nutritional, maybe it's a dietary thing, maybe it's genetics. But there's also this other thing, Dr. George, I'm sure you're aware, is that the average child being born today is likely having smaller mouths. And this could be an evolutionary type thing, or it could be as a result of the environmental and, let's say, dietary exposures that people at large are getting exposed to, and potentially even the genetic predisposition for, what do we call that, the MTHFR mutation. We're seeing a higher incidence of tongue restrictions, which result in smaller developmental, let's say, developmental midface, where the middle from the nose to the chin does not develop fully. So the mouths and midface, structurally speaking, are not reaching their potential in many cases due to a restricted tongue, which then makes it hard for the kid to, for the child to breathe. And therefore, the crowding, the mouth breathing results in the saliva's ability not to buffer the acid formation. And we see higher incidence of cavities in children who have tongue restriction. This is why we screen every child in my practice for just that. Find out if the child was breastfed. Usually when the mom goes straight to the bottle, that's the first sign that the tongue is restricted and the child cannot latch on. If that child had latched on or was breastfed for a month or a year, that may not be enough to help that tongue, which is ultimately responsible for the shape and size and positioning of the jaws, to create the room necessary to allow the adult teeth to erupt in the proper position and therefore avoid the trip to the orthodontist. So again, there are many factors that will result, or I should say, yes, result in the formation or appearance of cavities in teeth. But I just want to dispel the rumor that it's, you know, it's not only sugar, it's more complicated than that. And again, most physicians are unaware. The pediatricians are completely unaware. And so again, going back to the OBGYN before the child's born, are also unaware. So again, people can get educated on it, but by the time I usually see those kids, there's so many things have gone on that we have to say, all right, listen, don't panic, mom. This is a sign. Our focus at that point, when a child's got multiple teeth that are affected, to say, listen, let's do what we can to preserve and help the still developing adult dentition, and say, all right, listen, our focus has to be on the adult teeth, and let's get that kid's jaw to develop correctly. Now, sometimes that does require orthodontic treatment, but before we send the child to orthodontics, we're going to have them screen for a tongue restriction. We're going to have them perhaps even consider a functional device that will help the child recreate the harmony required between the lips, the tongue, and the teeth that mimics breastfeeding to help develop the musculature and the tongue strength, which helps to form and enlarge the jaw bones to get that child. Again, if we get them early enough, we can affect that change and allow that child to develop their jaws naturally and maybe even avoid a trip to the orthodontist. So again, it really depends on what stage I catch when the child comes to see me versus, you know, if they're a 3-year-old or they're a 10-year-old, that's going to determine, you know, really what's going to be the course of action.
In a younger child or baby, are you looking at things like tongue ties so that
yes.
that release? Okay.
Just yeah. Curious. So in an infant, okay, then yeah, it's usually straight to the release, assuming that mom is having difficulty with the nursing, or the child's very colicky or is otherwise, you know, not a sleeper. Most, I'm going to say 8 times out of 10, it's a tongue restriction. Sometimes, however, I'll mention this. It's easy to pick on what we call an anterior tongue restriction. Dr. George, what that means is usually the front or side closest to the teeth. Mm-hmm. There's a ligament under there, which can sometimes easily be developed. Usually the neonatologist will determine that on day one during their exam once the baby's born. But there's also something called a posterior tongue tie, which is a little trickier to diagnose. So even if a child has their obvious tongue restriction released at a young age, it may help with nursing or the ability to latch on. But even then, it doesn't guarantee that that tongue will remain free and strong enough or have the range of motion required to help develop the jaws. So again, in a perfect world, we'd have every child screened. Once a child comes to my office, usually they're 3 years plus old by the time I see them. But a lot of the moms nowadays are getting hip to the idea that we should have my child screened, or that if they had a doula or some other birthing partner who is hip to the idea that, hey, you know, get your kid checked, take that child to a chiropractor, depending on the type of birth, whether it was cesarean or vaginal birth, the child should probably have some chiropractic care to get everything lined up and then get that tongue looked at, assuming that the child doesn't just latch on easily. So again, we're advocating all that stuff. We're suggesting to mom, we give four or five different referrals sometimes, depending on the complexity of it. But thankfully there are, you know, a network of providers that realize, okay, we get these kids, we have a chance to really make a difference, quite literally, in the quality of life and also how beautiful these children look if we can get their teeth and their mouth squared away.
That's a great, great, great point. On that note, let's take our second break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Leonard Fazio. You know, I really didn't know how sophisticated this workup needs to be. I've done a lot of releases of tongue ties as a resident and as an attending, and I didn't realize how much that had the effect on jaw development. And for us in ENT, we're seeing people with crowded airways and sleep apnea. So there has to be some connection. If you can just make your intervention, there's so many things that are going to benefit the patient down the line.
Well, I would say that sleep apnea is of epidemic proportions, yeah? This is just the manifestation as an adult of a child who has restricted tongue. This is one of the other reasons why we want to screen this and have that conversation with mom or dad, saying, we're going to prevent this kid from having sleep apnea. We want that jaw to develop. And let me also say this, Dr. George, releasing the tongue in many cases is not enough. That tongue needs to be programmed. Okay. So a myofunctional therapist will, you know, evaluate to what degree the tongue is restricted and usually prescribe a exercise regimen, which is usually started in, let's say, not an infant, let's say a young child. The exercise programs usually started for about 6 weeks prior to having the tongue actually released, so that once the ligament or whatever is severed, the child is already in the habit of stretching their tongue out and having these certain exercise programs to increase that range of motion. But also, and maybe as is most importantly, to ensure that when the child is at rest, that the tongue is resting fully on the roof of the mouth. All right, so if we can imagine that the tongue is a beaver tail shape, a nice paddle shape, which is the exact shape we want for those beautiful arch forms that we're all wanting or that the orthodontist has to create. And so if that tongue is resting there, it's doing a couple of things. One, as a child swallowing, it's pushing the two halves of the maxilla, the upper jawbone, apart, aiding in what we call cranial respiration, which helps keep cerebral spinal fluid forming and flowing evenly throughout the brain and skull. And it's also placing a light but constant anterior and lateral or side-to-side pressure due to the shape of that tongue resting on that roof of the mouth, which does two things. It creates that expansion, that side-to-side distance or width that we all need for the teeth to develop. It helps develop the midface, as I alluded to earlier. With the tongue resting on the roof of the mouth, it also pulls the lower jaw forward, at the same time helping to extend the length of the jaw, the lower jaw, which is a problem. And that's one of the major problems with the sleep apnea, is that it's the lower jaw is not developed enough. Usually wisdom teeth are going to have to be extracted because there's not enough room for them either. And then everything's piled up in the back there. So the volume, free volume of airway space in the back is significantly reduced for those persons with a tongue restriction. So again, sleep apnea, what are we doing? The average treatment out there for an adult person is just, again, treating the symptom, right? And again, in a full-grown adult person, we are somewhat limited in what our options are, but we would still suggest to someone to consider, if someone's on a CPAP machine or is being told they need one, or they're being given some sort of device to reposition their jaw anteriorly to prevent that snoring and such and that occlusion, then we're going to say, well, maybe consider having the tongue released. Let's get that adult patient to a myofunctional therapist and see what we can do to mitigate some of the severity of that apneic, of those apneic episodes. Again, we would, as you probably would know, we would recommend a sleep study to confirm that there's apnea, but then get a baseline data, potentially go through this therapy, and then check it again and see if the O2 saturation or oxygen saturation is improving, or the, you know, number of episodes decreasing of the apnea. And so we can still help out and maybe get somebody off a CPAP machine would be some of the, you know, the goals that we would have for an adult patient. Again, for the children, we're trying to say, let's avoid that altogether and get this stuff squared away as a child.
Well, then it makes me have a question now, the role and the effect of braces. So if you're trying to lengthen and extend and widen, what do braces do if they're trying to just push in the teeth to straighten the upper teeth?
Again, orthodontics is treating the symptom. Classic, right? There can be a help, though. I'm not going to trash orthodontics. It has its place. And again, if we catch a child that's, we didn't catch them early enough, let's say, or they're already eliminating signs that the jawbones are not catching up. Well, we can still advocate tongue release. We can still advocate myofunctional therapy or a functional device to help create the room required. But a palatal expander, it still has its place. So we're saying, all right, listen, this kid, this child is a four or five-year-old kid. They've already got a habit going on that's not helping to support the width and shape of their jaws. And usually those children have a narrow arch with a vaulted palate, which is the first symptom of tongue restriction. In which case we say, well, this palate is not going to expand on its own. And we can't wait long enough for a child to get hip to the idea or mom to drag that kid to a myofunctional therapist and wait for the functional device to help create that room. Sometimes we have to intervene and say, all right, listen, let's get this kid, give him a little bit of a head start. Let's get them to the orthodontist. Let's get a palatal expander in there, at least get the arch width or side-to-side dimension increased, which gives more room for the tongue to get up on the roof of the mouth. And then hopefully with the axial therapy, we can teach the tongue, assuming that it's been released of its restriction, to remain up there. And then I say, oh, listen, we're giving you a little bit of a head start here, kid. Now you got the room to get your tongue up there. Let's have you keep your tongue up there. And by rights, help pull that lower jaw forward. In a perfect world, the lower jaw dimension will also widen. And if, again, depending on the kid, maybe we still need some orthodontics to kind of fine tune the positions of teeth later on, depending on the kid. Because, you know, we could talk about this all day long, but patient compliance is also really key here. we could talk and lead a horse to water, as they say. But, you know, if the child's not doing the work or mom and dad are not up with, you know, demanding their kid do 15 minutes here for their tongue exercises, then, you know, not everybody, you know, gets the success as quickly as we would like. But so in that case, then orthodontics is, you know, has its place. The thing that really irks me, and one of the first things I learned early on about orthodontics is that it's all too common because of the insufficiency. Now we're going to call this a skeletal issue, not a dental issue. But when the jaw bones, the upper and lower jaw bones are undersized because the tongue had not been freed up soon enough, then when those adult teeth come in, which are much larger than the primary dentition, there's no room for them, right? Because there's a severe crowding. And what does the orthodontist say? Hey, there's not enough room for all the teeth. At that point, they're not able to do much for the dimensions of the jawbone, maybe a little expansion here and there, but overall, you cannot change the length or size of a child, you know, for an average kid around age 10, 11 years old. And so, unfortunately, a lot of children are told, well, we're going to take out four perfectly good teeth in order to create the room required to reshuffle the rest of those crowded teeth and, you know, put them together side by side like good little soldiers. The net result there is that the mouth gets even smaller. Now you're crowding in, you're pulling teeth out. Now you're pulling all the teeth and pushing them in. And so those persons who had that experience at the orthodontist, taking out perfectly good teeth because there was no other alternative, they're more prone to apnea. They're more prone to grinding their teeth because of the tongue restriction. They're more prone to developing cavities. They're more prone to neck and back pain and all the other things that go with restricted tongue.
Amazing. It's just so, you have to know what you're doing from the beginning in order to have the person develop in a way that mitigates all of these other adult issues.
So that, and what that means is that a child should be seen by a biological dentist. Again, we were not taught this in dental school. So no dentist is, I shouldn't say no dentist, but most dentists are not screening for this. And just say, okay, your kid needs braces. Okay, here you go. Let's send them off to my friend, the orthodontist over there, and he'll take it. I did that for many years because I didn't learn that in school. But now that I see it, I see it every day. I see it in people in the, when I'm I don't know, I could drive to work and look at the person next to me at the stoplight going, oh, restricted tongue. that person's going to be on a sleep apnea machine. You know what I'm saying? It's that pervasive that most people, let's say a good number of people have this, but to varying degrees. Mm-hmm. Again, unless someone's got a speech impediment or is, you know, choking on their food or whatever, you know, a lot of us slip under the radar with a tongue restriction. And again, we go to the orthodontist, we treat the symptom. Maybe you're not, you know, showing issues in the first 30 years of your life, but maybe the second 30 years, you start having these weird things as parafunctional habits kick in and people clench or grind or they lose a tooth and teeth shift and now the dimensions of the mouth change. That's usually the contributing issues toward why someone develops apnea later on. So again, it's complicated. It's not everybody, it's not one size fits all, but again, we just got to try to just at least try to look at every child that comes through there and say, listen, what can we save this kid from a life of misery and get them squared away and then give a nice, beautiful smile in the process? That's basically a major function of pediatric biological dentistry.
That's awesome. Let's take our last break because I want to talk about the other side of dentistry. When you have people who have infections like this patient that I had, and it goes on forever. Yes, and I know she's not alone. So let's take our last break and come back. Okay. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. And again, you can go to Dr. Fazio's website, holisticsmiles.com. And we talked a lot about development and how we can keep children from becoming problematic adults, because I'm seeing them every day with people on CPAP, people with their airway just looks tight, crowded. Yes. But there's another subset, and everybody's got one, an infection in a tooth or a tooth that's been root canaled. My first question is, can you save a tooth that's infected and looks like it can't be saved? Is that something, can you regrow enamel? Can you actually reverse some of these problematic teeth?
Great question. If the nerve in the tooth, what we call the pulp, the nerve and blood supply and lymphatic tissue that's in the center of the tooth, if that has died off, then there is no saving the tooth. At that point, a typical patient is presented with two options. One is, let's save the tooth, and then root canal therapy is going to be advocated, or I hate to use the term required, but in order for a patient to hold on to the tooth, a dentist will tell them, I'm going to do root canal therapy first. We're going to clean out the inside of that tooth, sterilize it, and put a filling in the root, and then we'll make a filling or a crown that goes on top. The issue there, Dr. George, is that the tooth can never be fully sterilized. So invariably, if someone says yes to the root canal, because as I was alluding to, the alternative is removal of the tooth or extraction. Most people would be mindful or of the mind to say, no, please save my tooth. And the dentist feels that they're also providing a major, you know, wonderful service by saving somebody's tooth. But yet, even the dentist is not fully aware of what the potential shortcomings are of this root canal therapy. So in a nutshell, we can solve one problem if there was pain and or swelling due to an infected tooth. A round of antibiotics and a root canal therapy can usually clear that stuff up, and then there'll be some sort of quote-unquote honeymoon phase or honeymoon period in which there are no symptoms. Again, depending on how fastidious the dentist was, how badly infected the tooth was, you know, at what stage was the infection caught, these kind of things can determine just how long that honeymoon phase is. But invariably, those teeth become reinfected again. Okay, now most people are not aware of this occurring. Rarely are there symptoms that indicate that the tooth is becoming infected again. There are exceptions, of course. In those cases, people are aware, maybe a feeling of pressure or pain or a occasional swelling that requires another round of antibiotics. But rarely is the average dentist going to say, hey, that's not good. That tooth's not responding the way we thought it would to the root canal, so let's pull it out now. Oh, no. Most times, every kind of effort is going to be made to hold on to that tooth, even if it's already exhibiting signs that are less than ideal, pain or swelling, until there's something major occurs, the tooth breaks or the patient's just, you know, dying in agony. But other procedures like redoing the root canal therapy, a surgical procedure called apicoectomy, which is usually the last ditch effort to remove the area of infection that's in the jawbone surrounding those roots as a means of trying to clear that area out and then amputate the roots and in many cases put an amount of mercury filling in the roots there. We call it a retrograde filling, kind of like putting a cork in a bottle to help seal that area off. And if that doesn't work, then an average dentist is going to say, all right, you got to get that tooth out. All right. In a biological practice, again, most of the patients I'm seeing do not have to be educated on this. Most persons have already done their homework by the time they come and see me, in which case they're not going to consent to root canal therapy. They'll, as you know, undesirable as it sounds, they'll just opt to have the tooth removed in order to not subject themselves to this chronic infection situation that usually pops up once someone says yes to the root canal. So the concern we have for those persons who do say yes and are having no symptoms is that there could be this sort of behind the scenes action going on, this signaling to the body that something's not right. And in response to that, the body will either start developing a chronic reaction, in a worst case scenario, a autoimmune reaction, which is just that, a chronic reaction to some negative stimulus or infection, in which case, by the time something like an autoimmune disease appears, rarely is anybody connecting the dots between the fact that someone had root canal therapy done and then maybe a year or two or three or 10 years later, a disease appeared. But if you do the research, you'll find that root canals have been implicated in all sorts of diseases, ranging from, let's say, arthritis, which is an inflammatory disease, or things like, on the other end of the spectrum, cancers, or any other of the chronic diseases. So in a biological practice, we're saying, well, if we can avoid root canal therapy, that'd be great. Again, that would go back to talking about the nutrition and getting the patient squared away at an early age to give that patient, to give themselves the advantage to not have a tooth progress to the point where it requires root canal therapy. Again, this is in cases that don't, you know, not involving trauma, okay? But in the case of poor hygiene or multiple cavities or whatever it was that resulted in the need for root canal therapy, you know, the best medicine is to, you know, prevent that years and years prior. But for those persons who, you know, come and they're presented with the option, then most people nowadays are saying, no, I don't want to put myself on that merry-go-round and potentially have a problem with a tooth causing me issues later on. And so those persons will opt to have the tooth removed at that point. But there's one other thing we didn't get a chance to talk about earlier that might also give the patient the ability to not have root canal therapy. Okay. And let me explain that. In many cases, a person receives root canal therapy if a cavity formed in a tooth and it got really deep and infiltrated and infected the what we call the pulp or where the nerve is. That's a common scenario. In that case, again, there's nothing we can do about that. If that tooth's already died off, the patient's presented with, again, the need for root canal therapy or to have the tooth removed. But a lot of times people wind up receiving root canal therapy just because a cavity is deep, or that the tooth is exhibiting a symptom that is painful. Okay, so in many cases, a deep cavity can be getting close to where the nerve is, and again, we'll get a toothache, which can sometimes be severe. And many dentists say, well, you got a pain or a deep cavity, that means root canal therapy. And even if the tooth is not infected at that point, or the nerve is still not dead, again, a tooth that's still exhibiting pain could be that the nerve is just aggravated. But if the nerve is still alive and there's no evidence of infection, sometimes people wind up receiving root canal therapy anyway, just as a means of eliminating the pain. Okay? To me, that's a mistake. But the patient doesn't know any better, and the dentists don't have any other alternatives to help that patient out. Or they might not even be interested in avoiding the root canal therapy. And again, I'm not here to trash my profession, but I will tell you, there are incentives for dentists to do root canal therapy, because if someone has dental insurance, once root canal therapy is done, then the dentist automatically gets the green light to do the root canal. To do the post and the crown that finishes the job after the root canal therapy is done. So some dentists say, "Look, you need root canal. We're going to save your tooth. We'll put a cap on there, and everything's good." And the patient's like, "Oh, okay, my insurance is covering it. Yeah, great. Okay, let's do it." What a biological dentist is going to say is, "We'll pump the brakes." And Dr. George, I've had, I don't know, hundreds of patients, even in just the last, I would say the last 10 years, okay, where if they come, they've been told by another dentist that they need root canal therapy, but there's no evidence of infection, and they're coming to me for a second opinion, I'll tell them, okay, let's take what's called a cone beam x-ray. Dr. George, it's a three-dimensional imaging, a dental CAT scan, if you will, of the tooth to verify that there is no evidence of infection or pathology. And if so, I'll tell the patient, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to save your tooth, but not with root canal therapy. We're going to save your tooth and just allow it to stay vital or alive by properly cleaning the area out. And depending on the situation and how emergent or how much of an emergency that situation is, there are certain times I might tell the patient, listen, before I see you, I want you to take certain supplements that might be anti-inflammatory. Dr. George, for example, anything that would boost immunity. Also natural anti-inflammatory protocols, like, let's say, all your antioxidants with some omega-3 fats or things like that, to try to prep the patient first, then let them come back to my office at a later date, assuming that they're comfortable enough. And then when I take the cavity out of the tooth, we numb the tooth, excavate most, if not all, the decay. Certain times we have to stop taking all the cavity out so as to not mechanically or drill into the area where the nerve is. And then what we do is we use dental ozone, okay? Ozone as a means of sterilizing the tooth. And again, I'm going to say ozone, but it's really oxygen and ozone gas. We have a medical grade a machine in our office that creates it on demand. And I dial up a certain gamma or a concentration of that oxygen ozone gas. And I essentially fumigate, or the medical term is insufflate, or fumigate the inside of the tooth prior to me putting new filling in there. And what that does is a couple of things. One, it sterilizes any of the bacteria that are affiliated with that decay. And secondly, it remineralizes or hardens the decay that I might have had to leave behind so as to not mechanically expose the nerve. And then put a special non-toxic regenerative filling over that and put our non-toxic resin over the top of that. The success rate of that is 95%+ if we get the patient at the right time. Okay, in that case, then we can say, well, we don't want to do root canal therapy. Fine, let's save your tooth. Give me that deep cavity. I don't care. If we treat it well, we don't abuse the tooth or beat it up in the process, then again, with a combination of good, gentle, proper dental care and maybe some nutritional and maybe some functional therapy on top of that, we can get that tooth to calm down and keep that tooth alive and everybody's happy. Again, not everybody's doing that, but that would be what someone in my office would be presented.
That sounds like a much better alternative than trapping infection and inflammation.
Correct.
And waiting for it to explode at some other point. So to me, that sounds like...
So that is the best medicine there. Right. Again, yeah. Assuming we can get that tooth early enough in the process of this cavity formation, and or that the patient's nutritional status is at least fairly decent. You know, I could do great work, but if the patient, him or herself, is really in a bad way nutritionally or has been compromised by who knows how many other medications at that point, sometimes even that's not enough. And if it doesn't work out, at least the patient feels like, all right, I tried. Mm-hmm. And they at least feel like, I think emotionally, that I tried that and now I'm in a better place if I have to say goodbye to the tooth. And they don't have any question in mind that they should have done the root canal or anything like that. You alluded to earlier about, you know, remineralizing or growing enamel. I wanted to pick up on that. In an adult person, rarely is that possible. If enamel is damaged or there's a cavity that's really deep in there, there's no remineralization protocol that's going to reverse a cavity in an adult tooth like that. When we can have the conversation about tooth remineralization, or let's call that reversing cavities, it has to be caught at a very early stage in the process. All right, typically we see cavities, again, in children, let's say, this is where it's most applicable, where we see a child for the first time and we tell mom or dad, okay, we see some small cavities just forming. And Dr. George, if those cavities are only confined to the enamel area, let's call it the outer shell of enamel that's on these teeth, mm-hmm. then we can have the conversation with mom or dad about a tooth remineralization protocol. At that point, we, again, assuming compliance by both the parent and the child, that we might have the ability then to reverse that process and right the ship, so to speak. Once the decay has passed through the enamel into the dentin layer, then the best we can do with remineralization protocol is maybe slow the process, or the rate at which the cavity expands, we can slow it. But invariably, those children will require some dental fillings in order to eliminate that threat to the nerve. Depending on the child, depending on the age of the child, there are many cases where if a tooth's getting ready to fall out, let's say we have a 9 or 10-year-old kid, got a deep cavity in there, we won't even treat it. We'll just let the tooth fall out, and, you know, why spend money on a tooth that's going to come out anyway? As long as we're not allowing the child to be at risk, then we can do that. But I want to say one other thing, because this is also important, and I think most readers should hear this, or most listeners should hear this. When I am having the conversation with a parent about remineralization, again, this is all about trying to prevent dental intervention. I'm going to tell that parent, listen, I have a certain protocol. It's requiring some, again, assuming we've ruled out the mouth breathing and the apnea and all these other tongue restrictions and so forth. We're going to say, all right, vitamin D3 levels have to be addressed. We want to get some alkalizing foods in the diet. And we want to get some probiotics, and we want to get that kid prepared. The fact is, it doesn't always work out, but at least we'll try that. And I'll tell the mom, the only way we could be able to track our progress, okay, because usually I'm not seeing the child for another few months before they come back, I will tell them, much to at least initially their chagrin, is that the only way for me to monitor this is that I'm going to have to take x-rays on your kid each time they come in and track it. And if these spots are getting bigger, then we know that this protocol is not working. And at that point, I might have the conversation about saying, all right, we have to treat this tooth now. So although we're using digital x-rays, most parents are really paranoid about dental x-rays. But I'm going to tell you that this issue comes up a lot about, you know, are they absolutely necessary? And unfortunately, they are. All right. Medical, legally speaking, I am required to take x-rays, which is one of the ways I've been able to stay out of trouble. People ask me all the time, well, you're holistic. Why are you taking x-rays? Don't you think that's bad? And I say, well, too much of anything is bad, but there are certain times when it is appropriate. And if you have a dental office that has digital processing, there are certain machines out there nowadays, with the advance in technologies, that the amount of ionizing radiation is significantly lower than it used to be. But the fact is, we have to be saying, listen, if we're going to try this remineralization and not send the kid right to have fillings done, then we have to track it. And again, for me, legally speaking, I have to be careful to make sure we don't allow that child to be put at risk by my, you know, telling them, hey, we're not going to treat this tooth now. Okay. So anybody who's worth their salt is going to say, hey, sorry. Listen, if you're really worried about X radiation, which unfortunately is a necessary evil, then we can say there are things you can do to prepare for it. Again, upping your antioxidants. I have homeopathic remedies I give out to my patients in the office, you know, before, during, and after the X-ray exposure. At least we're mitigating the negative effect of the ionizing radiation, squashing those free radicals and mitigating any tissue damage. So again, necessary evil, it has its place. But in that case, like I said, if we're trying to monitor this and we don't want a cavity to get big, we unfortunately don't have any other way of seeing this. I think what'll happen is there are going to be other imaging things, other kind of cameras, for lack of a better term, that might be able to peer into the tooth without radiation. Scanners of some kinds that are used in the mouth, that I know the technology is being developed, but until then, unfortunately, most parents are going to be told, hey, you're going to have to take, you know, checkup or progress x-rays on your child just to make sure that this is working, and then go from there.
Well, you know, Dr. Fazio, time goes way too quickly, and I have to have you come back because I'm sure there's other topics that we need to address. But I want to thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome.
Again, people can go to your website, holisticsmiles.com. And I want to thank you again for joining me. And I want to thank everybody for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.